Blog Talk Radio.
We've got film, and we've got psychology. When we put the two together, we've got filmcology. Each week, we will look at the psychology of the characters in film, and it gives us something lovely to think about. So, let's get started. Filmcology is now.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Filmcology, where we look at the psychology behind a film that's chosen. It either the characters or the film or some aspect in the film. So anyway, this is a wonderful movie by Luc Besson. Some of you may know that he did the movie Little Nikita. Okay, so it's another film about hit person, a woman who was made to become a hit woman because of whatever circumstances. But this film basically thrusts a little girl in the film who's dealing with such unbelievable characterizations of the DEA and bad cops and bad parents and all that. What's interesting, I'm going to go into my take on everything, or I'll explain a little more on the film. But what's interesting is when I looked up a little more about the film, I found Roger Ebert's review on the film, which I tend to think quite great things about Roger Ebert, but I was kind of amazed at his, he seemed psychologically off about some of the things that he put in there, and who knows where his head was at the time, but it's, yeah, I don't think that it matched up quite the same way that I guess I would look at it as somebody who has a degree in psychology or a couple of degrees. Anyways, so let's just go ahead and take a look at this film. I'll describe it a little bit. Well, I'll describe most of the whole thing, and then we'll get into some discussions. I noticed that we do have at least one caller, and I'm going to unmute her. If she would like to join in, she's certainly welcome to talk about some of the aspects as I go through. Hold on one second. Let's see here. Okay.
Hello.
Hi, Lydia. How are you today?
I am most excellent.
That's great. Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead and start. If there's some little thing in the beginning that you'd like to sort of pop in, that'd be, you know, that just pop in.
Okay.
So, anyway, today's the psychological theme that I think is about this show that's most important is sort of how love can affect your life. It's something, even if you don't want love to affect your life, once it comes in, it's almost like, again, it's like balls on a pool table. If you've got a ball that's going one direction and another ball hits it, then it sends it off on another trajectory, and then it could hit another ball, and all the balls start getting affected by this one ball adding to the mix, which is basically what happens when love comes into our life. It can even be almost fatal in some ways. The model of the film is that, or basically the assertion in the film is that love is worth it no matter what, even to the very end, even if it could affect your life almost tragically. So this film also talks about family and how biological families may not always be the best families for you to contend with, or the non-traditional families that are out there. And I know a lot of people are sort of confused about what family is, so they split it off into other ways, like they use words like family and all that kind of weird crap, which, yeah, I mean, if you use it, that's fine. But do I need to actually make up a word to say that my friends are like my family or essentially my family? Not really. It just, it's almost like trying to give more information than is, it's a ridiculous redundancy. Friend, family, if they're a real friend, they're probably already your family. And I don't know. But anyways, moving along. The opening of the film gives you a hint to the primary characters just simply from the music. As it starts out and it's moving, the film moves into New York City, you hear this really sort of melancholy, haunting music, but it's sort of sweet in a really minute way. And then we open up the very first scene that you see with any people. A man actually asks in Italian, he says hello to the other person, and he's saying hello to Leon. He asks he says, hello Leon, how are you, in Italian. And then he goes on about a particular job, and all you see is their eyes and then these hands that are around a glass of milk. So psychologically, that scene has got to tell you that there's got to be some anonymity. There's a reason you don't really want to know the identity of the people. Whatever is being discussed is not something that you would necessarily want people to know about. And then to put a little irony in there, it's like you don't see what you would normally see with someone you consider a hitman, a glass of bourbon or a glass of scotch or something, or whiskey. You see a glass of milk. And then the scene moves out to more, a bigger view as we see the little girl. So you see all the principals pretty much in the first scenes. The little girl, she's sitting, you see her feet, see her little tiny legs through sitting through the railing work of a hallway, and which even when I saw that, the first thing I thought about is the time that I got my knee stuck in some railings when I was a little girl, probably around 9, 10 or something. I stuck my knee in a railing. Who knows why? Kids just put themselves in all these little weird places. There's just something about being a kid where you sort of, and maybe it's when you're a kid who comes from a family that where you sort of not appreciated, and you know, basically nobody wants you around. You're underfoot and you're an inconvenience. I'm not really saying that that's the way my family felt, but quite honestly, I'm sure they were glad when I wasn't about bothering or underfoot. And so I was somewhere sticking my knee through a railing, and she was sitting there with her legs handing me, and then you just see this sweet little kid. She's so cute. And then when he walks up, this professional who's all in all dark, long coat, has these wonderful round dark glasses, as he walks by, she says very, very innocently and sweetly, hi. And you start to see the contrast immediately. And then he turns and looks at her, because he doesn't even look like he would ever speak to anybody. And she had hid her cigarette just slightly or put it off to the side. And he asks her about the cigarette, why would you hide the cigarette? And her response is, because there's so many rats in this building. I don't want my old man to find out. And so as he starts to continue on down the hallway to his place, she said, hey, before he actually continues down, as he's looking at her, he notices something about her cheek. And there's a bruise on her cheek. And he asked her what happens, and she just made a lame excuse. I fell down on my bike. You know, a bike that none of us ever sees. And then he turns to go back to his apartment, and she says, hey, don't tell my father. So that I was smoking. Okay, so as this professional goes through his door and as he's closing it, then we see the next principal, Gary Oldman, come out. He's got headset on, and we just see the back of him mostly. And another man walks out with the little girl's dad and is yelling at the little girl's dad about missing heroin, that there was 100% and now it's 90%, so the heroin's been cut and all this kind of stuff. And he's trying to explain to this guy it very loudly. It's like this guy can smell, he can sniff it out when the heroin's totally missing or there's some problem. And I'm telling you, he's got like a sixth sense or whatever. And the guy's like, I didn't take it. It wasn't me. I had nothing to do with it. So this guy is just, we're dealing with criminals. Usually when you hear anything about how much heroin and it's cut and all that, it's nefarious. So the guy who was yelling just kind of hangs his head like, I've tried to give you a way out and you're just not taking it. And then Gary Oldman turns to the man and he says, oh, I'm sure he didn't take the stuff. He didn't cut the stuff. And he sniffs at the man's neck and his head, and then he whispers something in his ear, which makes this man, who's the little girl's dad, look even more worried. And then they walk down the stairs. They walk away. As they go down the stairs, he yells over the stairs, I didn't take it. And before he left, Gary Oldman said, find out who did it by noon tomorrow. And so then the man, he looks down at his daughter and he starts yelling at her, what's she doing out there? And, you know, go do your homework. And she said, yeah, I've already done it. And then he slaps her across the face and says, well, get in there and help clean up the house with your sister. And so we see this. And then you realize that the professional has been watching it all through his peephole. And he closes the thing from his little peephole. He goes in there and he puts his little plant. He's got a plant. He puts that on the windowsill for sun. And then he irons his clothes. You start to see how meticulous this man is. His whole room is extremely barren. It's the whole apartment. There's just not really anything in there. There's a table, a chair. There's just really nothing. And after he irons his clothes and gets everything set up, then he sits in a chair and he turns the light out, and that's it till we go to the next scene, which takes us to a parallel of what's going on in their apartment versus his apartment in the morning. So in the morning, you see a girl working out. She's an older sister. She's obsessed. Her mother, the mother of the family, she's dressed like an absolute hooker. She comes around with too much makeup and, you know, ridiculous clothes, hooker, I guess, clothing. Whether she's a hooker or not is not really, you know, ferreted out. But then there's the little girl, and she said something about the TV, and the girl who's working out, she tells her that she better not even think about changing the channel. And the mom, the mother figure, says, you know, you don't do a whole lot. You really need to, you know, help out around here for somebody who does nothing but watches cartoons all day. She said, why don't you do something useful, like go get something to eat for breakfast? You know, go get us some food to eat. And then the dad, who's, you know, it's just an unkempt, crazy place, he's yelling and, you know, wants to, you know, whatever, you know, have some intimate time with his wife. The girl and her sister, you know, end up arguing, and the older sister, because she changed the channel, older sister beats her, you know, beats on the little girl. And it's just like, really sort of sad existence, as you can see from that. Well, while you're seeing that, at the same time, they're cutting back and forth into the professional's apartment, and he's working out. He's doing his sit-ups, and, you know, he's just getting everything ready because nothing's out of order. And it's like his place is so minimal that there's nothing to help it get out of order. So you understand, psychologically, he keeps his life simple and uncomplicated. And we see this little girl's life is nothing but complicated. It's not simple, as we find out more as we move into the film. And so the next thing we see is the professional, the hitman, he's in the movie theater. He goes to a movie, and he's watching Singing in the Rain. And in the Singing in the Rain, the song that we hear Gene Kelly singing is not Singing in the Rain. The words that we hear, this is Luc Besson's thing, how he uses music to infuse and cut things into his film. He said, what Gene Kelly is singing, why am I feeling when things could look black that nothing could go wrong? This has been a most unusual day. Love has made me see things in a different way. So we hear that, which also is portending what's getting ready to happen in this film. And then we see the professional coming back. And Matilda is standing there, and she's holding her nose. He pulls out a handkerchief and gives it to her, and there's blood from her nose, obviously from being hit again. And she just very sweetly asks, mind you, when she's doing this, the music is really sweet because it really takes time to make you understand from a psychological perspective that we're in the innocence phase as we're looking at this little girl, even though she's dressed rather avant-garde. She asks him, is life always this hard? Or is it just when you're a kid? And the professional says, always, and tells her to keep the handkerchief. She brightens up a little, and she even smiles, and she says she's going to the grocery store, and she'll pick some milk up for him. And then as she goes to leave, the violin changes from being sort of sweet and melancholy to extremely heavy bass. And then we see the professional go into his apartment, few seconds, and we see the clock. It's 5 minutes to noon, and then Gary Oldman and many of his crew start filling into the room. It's probably about six guys or something like that. Not into the room, but into the building. And then Gary Oldman, which is very interesting, the way he's such a perfect actor. I've never seen anything flawed by him. But as he walks in, after his other guys walk in, because his entrance is so important, he walks in and he says, he takes this pill out of this. I don't even know what the drugs are because I'm not a drug person. But whatever it is, it's pretty intense. He takes the pill and he crunches it under his teeth. And the whatever releases into his system actually sends tremors to him, and he has a really strange way of, like, he can handle this, which probably other people would take with water. I don't know. And he says, I like these calm little moments before the storm. It reminds me of Beethoven, which, okay, incidentally, Beethoven, he played Beethoven that year in a movie called Immortal Beloved. It's just amazing orchestration, the way the music and the psychology is wrapped around each other with these characters and the people and the film. And so he goes in, they go in to this apartment and they start killing everybody. We don't really see that there's a little boy in the mix until this time. He's hiding underneath a bed, We didn't see the little boy earlier in the day, and we didn't really see the little boy in the very beginning scenes. But now we know that there's a little boy in there hiding underneath the bed, and they're all looking for this heroin that's missing, the 10% that this guy claims he didn't steal. So they're tearing up the house and things like that, and then all of a sudden the little boy, he escapes from his hiding place, which surprises everybody, and then the shooting just goes all over the place. The men actually end up shooting one of the other guys as they're shooting all over the apartment, and the little boy gets killed. The dad is the last person to be killed, and I guess he was near his gun. And then Gary Oldman wants to talk to him about Beethoven and how he finally got sick of it. And then he says, "You're a Mozart man. I like Mozart too." It's trying to give you some sense of the psychology of this drug user who's in a position, he's a drug user. Your whole perspective is these are just bad men. They're drug pushers or drug users or something. That's the sense you get from the very beginning of this film. And then the professional who's in his apartment, he hears all the screaming and everything, and he starts watching out his peephole of his door. Now, it's not really quite sure, or it hasn't really pointed out that he was watching for the little girl to return from the store or not. We have no idea why he's looking, if he's just looking to see what's going to happen next, if he might end up, you know, having to shoot. We have no idea. But then there's a guy standing outside the apartment because they're still looking inside, and Natalie, the little girl, comes back with the bag of groceries. She's certainly got enough sense, obviously, from her hardened life at age 12, to walk right by her open door department where her dad is laying dead on the floor, and she gets over to the door where the professional is, and she's just very quietly just saying, "Please, please open the door, please." She's very quiet about it, and she's crying, and she's just the professional who's looking at this, like, he's almost like, "What do I do now?" Because he doesn't want to get involved, and yet there's this little girl who's in danger. And he finally, after he kind of like, he opens the door and lets her in, and she walks in as if she belongs there, and he closes the door, and he's still, like, not sure what to do, and he continues to watch out the peephole. The guy who was guarding the other, her apartment, where they're all doing everything in there, somebody else comes out and says, "Yeah, apparently there's another kid. You know, we missed one of the kids. You know, a little girl, shit, we got to find her." And so then the guy who was standing guard thinks, maybe. He walks towards the professional's door, and Matilda, the little girl, Natalie Portman's character, turns the TV on, for God's sakes, and cartoons. She turns it on to cartoons, and which panics the professional, and the guard outside the door thinks, oh, she must just live there. Because, you know, cartoons have gone on. So it actually ends up saving the situation at the moment. And then some guy finds the stolen heroin. And so as they were getting ready to wrap up, and, you know, they know one guy's dead, and Gary Oldman's having a fit because somehow his shoulder got shot, but he's more upset that his suit was ruined, and so he wanted to load up his now empty gun and shoot more bullets into the dead dad because his suit is ruined. I mean, so we're trying to, you know, Luke is trying to make us see how completely devoid of any kind of caring or anything. He's a bad, bad man. Gary Oldman is. And then one of the guys says, what do we, because you can hear the sirens coming, and he says, what do we tell them? It's like, that we tell them that we were doing our job, which then tells us something's not quite as it seems. And the little girl at some point is in the apartment with the professional, and this is how things start to unravel for the professional. He's sort of trying to comfort this little girl who starts crying. Now, I'm going to just jump back real quickly. When she was in all the dysfunctional melee of her apartment with her parents earlier that morning, there was a phone call, and nobody, of course, is answering the phone. Nobody, you know, because it's just a crazy household. And the dad's yelling, someone get the blinking phone. And she answers it, the little girl, and it's the headmistress to this private school. And she said, well, we need to talk to the parents. And so she pretends to be her mother, or the person who acts as her mother. And she says, now, I know that your husband paid for a year ahead of time, but Matilda hasn't been here for 2 weeks. And unless we get a good reason why she's been gone, then you're going to forfeit your funds if you look in the rules and regulations. And Matilda simply says she's dead and hangs the phone up. So we know that she belonged in school and still hasn't been to school or hasn't been going to school. So when she's crying in the professional, back to the professional's apartment, she's crying. He's not quite sure how to comfort her, but he's sort of just listening to the logic. When she said, he said something about her father, you know, dying, and she said, oh, I'm not worried about that because I probably would have ended up killing him anyways. And then he said, so your mother, and she said, that's not my mother. And she said, and that other girl who's always trying to lose weight is like, it's just my half-sister and not the good half. And he said, well, if you don't like your family, why are you crying? And she said, because of my little brother. She said he was 4 years old, and he never did anything to anybody. All he did, he never even cried. He would just sit next to me and cuddle. I mean, so she wants them to pay for her little brother. And she asks him after he leaves the room, because he was saying something about, she said something about them being pig, or the mother was a pig, that she was more of a mother to her four-year-old brother than that pig. And he said, oh, don't say that. Pigs are good. Pigs are good, 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 good. You shouldn't say that about pigs. And it's like, she said, they smell like shit or something like that. And he says, no, they're very, very clean. He says, as a matter of fact, the pig in my kitchen is, he's very, very clean. He never makes a mess. And she said, I was just in your kitchen and there's no pig. Now, mind you, this little girl just lost her family and they're having this kind of strange conversation. And he said, well, I'll go get him. And he goes in to get this pig and he makes this snort sound and he comes out with a potholder that's a pig. And while it seems kind of stupid, you start to see again, even though she's sort of tough in the way that she sort of acts, but yet she's got a sweet little voice. She's still a little kid. And at one point, when he left to go look for the pig, she opens the case that he had in on his table, and it's full of guns. And so that's how she finds out he's a hitman. And she asks how much he would charge to pay to get those guys who killed her little brother. It's $5,000 a head. So her idea is, I'll work for you. You can teach me to be a cleaner, and then to pay for it. And he's like, no, you know, he doesn't kill women, he doesn't kill children. But no, she needs to go be with whoever her family. And she goes, I have no one. She said, I have no one. There's nobody. And she said, and if he basically told him, if you don't take care of me, then I'll be dead by tonight. she says that at the outset, he puts her to bed and she's clinging to this little potholder pig. And she said, you did really good with me, and it usually doesn't happen that way. Like, it's like this really strange, crazy situation that most people would be like, okay, where's Child Protective Services, blah, 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 blah. There's, you know, this girl doesn't fit in the world of a hitman. The hitman is just clueless on what to do, obviously, in interactions with other people. He normally doesn't even have to deal with other people. He just basically kills them and then, you know, goes back to his simple life. And so the next day, she pleads again about the cleaning, teach me to do this. And he's like, no, you're a kid. And I just don't think you have it in you. And he had given her a gun. He gave her a gun to say, there, go, you know, but you have to get out of here. You can't stay. And she takes the gun and she shoots out the window like 6 times in different directions. And she says, there, do you think, how's that? You know, like, how's that? I could do this. And the next thing you see, which sort of opens us up to the movie's, you know, main hearts of it, is she's holding the plan and rushing along beside him, and he's walking with his cases, and she's got whatever little stuff she had when she went to his apartment. And then finally he stops and he says, Matilda, don't ever do anything like that again. And she says, okay. And he said, that is not what I do. I that's not professional. And she said, okay. If you ever do that again, I'm going to, he said he's going to break her head or something. And she says, okay. And he said, stop saying okay, okay? And she said, okay. And then they went on. And that's kind of like how they went on. There's like his logic as a hitman, and then her logic is, I want to get those people who did that to my brother, and I don't really have anywhere to go. And, of course, the plant. So the movie progresses to where she does things to sort of get under his skin, and she gets him to sort of play games. In the very beginning, we never saw the professional Leon. His name's Leon. We never see him smile at all, except once during the film. And he loved that, you know, Gene Kelly, Singing in the Rain, this movie's so great, that he smiled in the empty theater. There was maybe one person in there watching this old film. And so then she starts playing games with him, like trying to get him to guess different characters and things like that. And he sort of, you know, acquiesces. And at one point he's cleaning the leaves of his plant, just cleaning it. He takes very good care of this plant, this, you know, nice green foliage plant. And she said, you love your plant, don't you? And he said, it's my best friend. And she said, if you really loved him, you'd plant him in a nice garden somewhere so it could, you know, grow and, you know, really, you know, whatever. She said, you should actually be, you know, watering and taking care of me so that I can grow up and whatever. And he said something like, I'll water you. And he went and he pulled the water thing and started, you know, spraying her with water. And she ran and got a tub of water and threw it on him. And you see that all of a sudden this professional who was very stoic and had a real uncomplicated life is now dealing with this kid. And she goes back after he finally goes back to his, I guess you could call him his handler or his contact. Because he hasn't done a job for a couple of weeks while he's been dealing with this little kid. And his handler, who was played by Danny Aiello, is an Italian dude, and he knows something's wrong. He's like, I haven't seen you for a while. And he goes, yeah. And he goes, you know, I have a lot of money, you know, saved up, because he never uses money. He basically does these jobs, he gets paid for them, and this guy, Danny Aiello, retains the money and takes care of it. And he says, well, I'm better than a bank. Banks can go down. They could do this or that, but, you know, I'm good for you. So we see this relationship. He's basically the only person that you can imagine that the professional really deals with. You don't see him even talking to anyone else in the restaurant. The only one who talks to the other people is Danny Aiello's character. And he said, what is it? He said, you met a woman? And he said, women, you know, it's a bad thing, you know, because it's not that it's a woman that is such a bad thing in this film, although that's what he says. You understand that the woman thing is because it's a distraction. And then any distraction for this guy is going to change things. And so then Leon, you know, leaves. The little girl is teaching Leon how to read and write. So because he couldn't read or write. And it's just like all of a sudden their lives sort of seem to make sense, but there's still this undercurrent issue of her little brother being killed. And she returns to her home, the scene of the crime, which they have cordoned off, and there's some police officers standing around still guarding it. And then she's in the apartment when Gary Oldman character walks in with two other men, different men, and they're investigating what could have happened with this shooting. They're concerned about the fact that there were children that were killed and what's going on, and he tries to explain that there's all these things that happened. He said, one of my men got killed, and it's like, yeah, but didn't you say you were the first one in the apartment? You know, what about the children? And so Gary gets really upset and says, you know, if you want to talk about this, then meet me at my office. And he gives the number of his office downtown, and then he goes outside. And Natalie follows in a cab, and she realizes as he walks into the DEA building, this guy's a drug enforcement officer. He's a police officer from that division. So it's or enforced whatever. He's somebody that shouldn't be doing this. And so that's when she starts thinking about how she's going to take him, care of him. She's just going to go there and take care of him, which one day she leaves and she goes under the guise that she's bringing him this bringing dinner to this office. But she sees Gary Oldman's character go into the bathroom, and so she goes and follows into the bathroom, and she looks for him under the stalls, and then when she gets to the end of the stalls, she turns around, and Gary Oldman was behind the door. So he's aware that she was watching him, and he goes up to her and asks her about what kind of food she's bringing, and then asks, he realizes that she's after him for a reason, and he asks her if it was what happened, and he asked if it was personal. She said, you killed my little brother, and then the tears start rolling down her face, and he said, yeah, see, do you love life? And she's like, yes. And he says, good, because I hate to kill somebody who doesn't even care about life. And he pulls out his gun, and he's ready to kill her when one of his men shows up and says that his partner had been killed in Chinatown. And they don't know who it was. They can't figure out why, and they think it was personal. And he looks back at the little girl who's just still staring with tears running down her face. And he's really angry now, and he says, take this little girl up to my office. So now she's at the office. She's being watched by two different guys. And the professional, he goes back home to find that she's left a note with the $20,000 she had found in her dad's apartment, or she knew was hidden there. And she said to pay him for the men for doing the job. to kill the other men and for teaching her how to do it. And but she said where she went because she found out where his office was and who he was. And then the professional immediately races over to the building. He kills the two men that are, as you walk in, he kills another guy going up, and he gets into the office, and he immediately shoots the two guys that are holding her. And then you see immediately how they are so, already it's too late. You know, I mean, she jumps into his arms, and he's just so glad to have her in his arms, and she's so glad for him to be there. So now we know the love has happened. It's too late. Everything's off kilter. I mean, this is the guy who's always ghosting. You don't ever see him coming. You don't ever see him leaving. But now he's walking in shooting as he walks into a building. There's no getting around the fact that everyone saw him. And they go back to their apartment. And she had already told him that she was in love with him. And he didn't really know what to do that. He had saw the guy, his handler, and he told him, the little girl that was here the other day said, if anything happens to me, I want you to give her the money. So, you know, and Tony, his handler is, you know, you can tell the disapproving look like, things are all screwed already. So then the film, at this point, the little girl is happy. She goes out the next morning to get some breakfast and some milk for them. She's just got all this spring in her step. She's overjoyed because mostly not that they've killed some of these guys, but it's like she's finally in a family that loves her, that would come for her, that is willing to take care of her, even in the worst of times. And she gets ambushed on her way back into the apartment. And they have a special knock between them for when she comes back, and she tells the snipers that Gary Oldman brought, like, a whole bunch more guys, and they're all in black snipers, whatever, that while Gary Oldman waits downstairs to get this guy and this girl, she gives them the knock, but it's the wrong knock. So when they enter the apartment, Leon knows that it's trouble, and he starts shooting. And he takes out a bunch of them, because they were holding her captive, and he got her back. So it comes down to where they're trapped in the apartment, and he's trying to send her down the ventilation chute, and she doesn't want to go. And she says, please don't. She said, I love you. And he said, you can't fit down the chute. And he goes, it's okay. It's going to be easier if I'm alone. And you need to go. Meet me at Tony's in 1 hour. And he had already sent the plant down the chute first. And he says to her, it's like, I will, you know, we're going to go. And we're going to go away and do fun things or whatever. And he said, it's going to be easier for me alone. So she escapes down the chute. And they send an explosive into the apartment. He actually takes one of the dead snipers and he dresses in their garb, and he is injured, but they're taking him downstairs thinking that they don't realize it's him after all the smoke and everything clears. She's able to leave the building because nobody's paying attention to her with the plant. The professional, Leon, he's almost out of the building, except Gary Oldman saw him at the very end, and he called everyone away from the building, and he went back in just as Leon was getting ready to leave, and he's almost to the very opening to get out of the building scot-free, and then you see a blast, and then he's on the ground. And as he's on the ground, Gary Oldman comes over to him, stands over him, and he starts saying something to him because he thought he was dead. But he sees there's something in his hand. And then Leon, he actually presses what's in his hand into Gary Oldman's hand, and he says, "This is for Matilda, or from Matilda." And it's the pin of a grenade, which is attached to about 8 other grenades. And so that took out that, and then the next thing you see is the little girl with the plant at Tony's, Danny Aiello's little restaurant, and he said something about, well, that's it, it's all done then, you know, such and such, and he said, "I told Ben I would take care of you," and he pulls out some money, and he hands her $100 bill, and he says, "There, take that," and, you know, and she goes, "Well, I could work for you, I could, you know, I could be a cleaner," and he says, "I'm not," he starts yelling like the typical Italian, and the one I know, starts yelling at the top of his lungs, "I don't have any jobs for any goddamn 12-year-olds. And it's like, you need to get your little ass back to school and take that $100 and I better not see you for another month." And she starts crying, and he says, "Yeah, you know, it's hard on both of us. You know, I mean, basically, they're both sad about Leon being gone." And he said, "Now go on, get to school." And she goes to school, to this private girl school, and the teacher said, and she tells the headmistress, "Well, my parents died in a car crash." And she said, "Matilda, now we're going to take you back, but only if you stop lying. You must stop lying and tell me the truth." And she said, "Okay, my parents were killed by the DEA, they over drugs, and a hitman was taking care of me, and he was killed today. And if you don't let me stay, then I'm going to die tonight." And then the headmistress's look was like, holy cow. And then the next thing you see is her walking across the grass, the yard at the school. She goes to the edge of the yard, and she's planting the plant. And she says, "Leon, I think we're going to..." "Be okay here." And it's just okay, so that's the movie. Geez, oh man, I took the whole time to say it. But anyway, so let's talk about some of the psychological things, you know, things that impressed you, whatever. This little girl, Roger Ebert, which is interesting, he sort of didn't think, I got the impression he didn't think it was all that realistic for a 12-year-old to be put in this world. Which I can only say this. People who seem to be so far removed from the poor, the dysfunctional, the most seedy sides of society always say that's not realistic. I served on a jury, and there was this man who was from an upper crest side of my area, my region in Bellevue. And he said, "I just don't believe that anyone would be driving around with a broken back window." I thought, okay, he's never been to Seattle proper. I mean, that's like in all kinds of neighborhoods in Seattle. But it just, when he was stating it, you already knew that when he was going to make a judgment for the guy who was on trial that, you know, there was something wrong with it, so he was going to judge harshly. He had no idea that that is actually realistic. Now, Roger Ebert is a very respected film, whatever, but I think he didn't really understand the truth about some real life situations that go on in society. That situation sounds really horrific, but I don't think it's that uncommon in certain parts of New York and different other places in the world, wherever. Maybe you won't have DEA agents doing that, but predators or bad people happen to 12-year-olds and under all the time, and their lives are constantly compromised because of dysfunctional families, which is, you know, why people like me are, you know, always hauled into family court and stuff like that. And quite honestly, in Seattle, which is not New York, it's not quite as hard-edged. there's a lot of horrific situations. Even when I was a child advocate for the court system to go and interview all these different people in the lives of these children, I found it amazing how completely clueless parents who are on drugs and alcohol are, and what they put, the positions they put their children in, and they were much younger than 12. So, Roger Ebert's review, you need to watch the film for yourself and I guess make the judgments based on whatever upper crust life or lower crust life you've lived in. And I'll ask this, do you think it's realistic that you can love people that are much, much farther away from you than your biological family? Do you think that there's anyone that has treated you better than your biological family? Then I think this is quite realistic. It doesn't matter how harsh or protected you are from people you think you don't want to love anyone. You know, whether a dog comes into your life or a plant or a garden or whatever, somehow love will come into our life in the weirdest ways. And families, non-traditional families, are basically the most normal there is out there these days. What do you think? Are you there? Okay, it's just probably just me at this point. So,
no,
okay,
no,
and we're almost out of time anyway. But, it's a good movie for you to take a look at, you know, if you've been hiding your heart for a long time because you felt like, you know, either people didn't care or you felt like people were too much trouble or you only had trouble with people either in your family or outside your family. But I do believe that love is worth it even if it's, you know, messy and sort of, you know, dysfunctional. But look around you. Most people who are in dysfunctional and creepy lives, there's somebody who's offering something that's better. You just may not be trained to recognize it when all you've ever known is dysfunction.
Yes, Brenda.
Anyway. Yeah?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, I related to the movie and it made me cry. I cried. I almost called you up and yelled at you. Not yelled, but just said, "Why are you making watching movies?"
You'd never seen the film before?
No, I'd never seen it till this afternoon. I watched it, and it was very touching, and I completely related to the little girl. You know, I felt in my childhood kind of lost and wanted someone to love me. I didn't have quite the drama she had, but I really liked it, and I thought there were a lot of layers. The layers of him, you know, came to this country and didn't know how to read or write, and that she taught him, that really touched me and was a good point of it. And I think that the Danny Aiello character was kind of creepy from my point of view because he was like, yeah, you know, and I've got your money for you. But, you know, he didn't want to give him the money. He didn't want to give him the money. He gave him a job when he first came, and I'm sure he gave him enough money to live on, but he lived very simply. And that's what I read into the Danny character, that he was not wanting to give the money. You know, he knew that he needed to pay him some money, but he didn't really want, he's like, oh, it's, you know, it's better than, you know, it's better for me to have it. And, you know, he had these reasons, and then he cited them to the little girl, and then he, like, gives her $100, like she could live on $100. You know, I don't know, that to me was weird. And that she felt like she was in love with him is because she never knew love.
Right, right.
But, and it was kind of weird when she told the guy that kept their seedy apartment, when she said to him, he's really not my father. He's my lover. And then he did end up getting kicked out. But he never, you know, I mean, she knew that, like, she did something wrong, and the dad, her biological father, would have beaten the tar out of her.
Oh, yeah.
And he never did, and he never did, and he was very loving to her.
Yeah. Well, I thought about the Danny Aiello character when I first saw this movie many years ago, and I think I kind of had that take, but what I think is he mostly worried. I got this impression that he cared about Leon in a way almost like he was a child. Like, he wouldn't know what to do with all that money. He doesn't do anything with his life, and he did set him up. But as far as the little girl, from my understanding, he understood that the girl should be in school at a private school. So otherwise, $100, I don't think he would have done that if he thought she needed a place to live. Because even the way he said, get your butt back to school, it's like he already had an understanding, but they didn't really, you know, illuminate that she was in a private school. She needed to just go back there. And otherwise, I think he probably would have, you know, done something to set her up, because I do think there is that semblance that he might possibly be using the money for other things, but as I really watched his character from the beginning to the end, it's like he needed him to stay as he was because he was a good moneymaker. He needed him not to be encumbered with other wife, you know, stuff, because he was a good moneymaker. And so I think he sort of tailored things based on the way Leon was. And Leon was just, he really, quite honestly, if you stop and think about it, this is, like you said, he's not educated. You know, he has no life. He really doesn't know anything. It's almost like an idiot savant or somebody that you would be taking care of, right? Say, like, as if, or if you were... or if he was somebody who had some handicap or something, he took care of everything. And, you know, if he didn't, then he'd probably have nothing. So, I don't know. It stirred out of the judgment for me on that one. And I'll just, it would be interesting.
Also, since I just saw it, you know, in the movie, it was unclear that he knew that she had gone to this private school, and that I just saw the movie, and the father had paid when the headmistress called the father at one point, but it was Natalie on the phone, or Matilda, listening, she said, well, and you have paid for a year, but if you read the contract, if you don't go, blah, 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 blah. Well, so that's why she knew she could go back there. Now, whether they just cut the scene or where she says, well, I could go to school, you know, my dad paid for the school, but Danny Aiello didn't know that. You know, and he was
it's almost like there was, it's just enough that, because when he says, you know, get your butt back to school, that's giving you some idea that he might know. Now, we don't know all of the conversations that Tony had with Leon about the little girl. We just saw a couple of them. So, you're right. I mean, it leaves it to chance, you know, and it does make him, it makes him seem creepier, yeah.
And he wanted, you know, he wanted this hitman to be, you know, the same always, and didn't want to change. He was a great hitman. And when he did the job after not doing any jobs for 2 weeks, he got wounded. And that was totally out of his character. And I feel that was him. Well, right before he left for that job, she's lying on the bed and she said, I think I'm in love with you. And he said, well, how would you? And she said, well, because of this feeling in my stomach. And when he leaves the apartment, he leans against the wall. And you know, to me, it was like, oh, my God, he's having a really hard time with this. And so
he has to be careful now because if something happens to him.
Well,
yeah, if something happens to him, this little girl is left with nobody. You know, he now has to consider outside of himself.
Right.
Now,
But
I will
it also
say
made
this.
Him less. It made him less reliable as a hitman, and he didn't get the job done. He got shot.
Yeah, he got shot. Well, we don't know that he didn't get it done. We just know that he got shot. So
he
probably got the job done. Huh?
When he goes to see Danny, he said, did you do the job? And he said, no, I didn't get it done or whatever. And he said there was something. I didn't quite hear the word he said. And that was a surprise to the Danny Aiello character, too. And,
he actually said he didn't get it done?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't hear that. I'll have to go back.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, so, he, and I think it was because he was so distracted because he was thinking of someone else for the first
time.
Well,
yeah. I mean, I think that when you're fearless and you have nothing to lose, you don't worry about all these other details. When you do have to worry about somebody, then you're, they constantly say that when you become too careful, then you become reckless. And that sort of old adage. But I will say this one more thing for Danny Aiello's character, and that's only because of the Italian way of doing things or the Sicilian way that it's like these are, things seem kind of rough, but there is a real inherent undercurrent about when you care for somebody, you wouldn't do them wrong that way. Although we do know most likely that he found out where they were living from the Tony character.
Right.
But if he really
right.
didn't care about Leon, I think he probably felt Leon could handle himself. But if he didn't care about Leon, he wouldn't continue. He could have just told the kid, I don't know anything about it. He could have.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have to even do that. He didn't have to bother.
Right.
So it just seems to me like, he wouldn't. He said, if you want all the money, you can come back, whatever. And he goes, and he gave him $1,000. He's like, he goes, yeah, okay, da da da. So, yeah, I think, there's a lot of questions, Luc Besson doesn't give it neatly. He does a lot of psychological inferences, through the music. And, yeah. I thought he did well, though, as far as how he directed the film. And I thought it was very clear that I thought it was very realistic, actually, that a kid could be in that horrible situation because, like I said, when I did advocacy through King County Superior Court, there were parents that were doing creepy things like that, and their children were in the midst. So.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes on all the time, I think. And, you've got your head in your, you've got your head in the sand if you think that it doesn't. I agree with that part, definitely. And it made me, I was really touched by the two characters. And I thought Natalie Portman was excellent.
Oh, yeah. Those roles were played well. I mean, the fact that we don't really know what Danny Aiello's character, which is he kind of bad or good, that was well played. Gary Oldman, absolutely insane on drugs, whatever. And then Jean Reno, just his usual sweet sort of funny, even when he plays a nefarious character, he always sort of has something sort of comical about it, sort of a weird sort of French comedy tone to it. He's one of the most beloved French actors out there. But, it was – and then Natalie, I don't know how old she was, but she played perfectly.
That was her debut. That was her acting debut. Oh, also, I do the drug was cocaine, not heroin. And also the Gary Oldman character, I believe what he was taking was a appetite suppressant, speedy thing.
Oh, was it?
Don't quote me on it, but I looked it up in the physician's handbook, and I believe that's what it was because it was green and yellow, a green and yellow capsule. Yeah.
Oh,
and
okay.
He played that. he played the creepiness so good, and the way he would like crack his neck, he'd put it in his mouth and look up, and then he'd kind of crack his neck, and then he'd be like, you know, almost ecstatic that, you know, because he got this rush because he cracked open the capsule. It was he was very creepy. It was good.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to watch the film and join me.
I enjoyed it, except that I cried, and I was like, I was going to say, what are you doing? I was going to call you immediately afterwards. Got busy. So.
Things are going to start lightening up, folks, on Filmcology. So I apologize. I know we've got a lot of documentaries, and I'm still trying to figure out how to format the month, whether we want to have one documentary and one creeper movie and then the rest. I mean, I'm just, you know, I my heart, the horror films are getting, you know, lost, but I'm going to try, summer, we're going to lighten things up. We're not trying to have not as many dark things to look at.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really a good film about, it really was good film about love and family and things like that.
I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, so, okay, well, let's just real quickly run down the films. I'm going to do a real quick rundown, folks, because we're already over time. Tomorrow at 5 p.m., there's Friday Traffic Jams, I believe, not sure. I think she's doing disco or something this week. So disco party tomorrow, yeah. And then that's at 5 p.m. with Lennis, Friday Traffic Jam. Saturday, since Lydia's here, we'll let her tell us about Time to Love at 2 p.m. Pacific Time.
Yep. Oh, it's going to be on love and marriage, and I am honoring my nephew and my soon-to-be niece. They're getting married that day, and so I wanted to talk about love and marriage.
Awesome. And you have a poll, right, on your Time to Love website?
Yes. And if you, it says, it's like in dark black letters, it says Time to Love Survey, or Love and Marriage Survey. And if you click on it, it'll take you right there.
Okay, great. So that's, you could go to time two with the number two, and then love with Lydia Pello. If you type that into your search engine, you should be able to bring you right to that, her website. Okay, and on Sunday at 3 p.m., every Sunday, there's psychic readings by Lennis. You can get a free psychic reading a question. She answers some questions. If there's time, she'll do a little more than that. Just pop in at 3 p.m., and she's got a special going on where every ninth caller gets a free hour psychic reading, and she can talk about all manner of things. And then on Monday, we have a special show in our series on Ella and B, Passage to Empowerment. We've been doing a series on personal power and empowerment. Last week, we did Releasing Women's Power. This week, we're going to be doing Illuminating the Man Cave with Sensitivity. That's going to be part two, and we'll have three special guests, gentlemen, who are going to tell you their ideas about power and how women fit into that or don't, however, whatever. And that's at 7 p.m., the new time for L&B, Monday, yeah. And then on Tuesday, we have BYO Brilliance, the Brilliance of Volunteering, at 6 p.m., and then on Wednesday in the studio with Lennis, she talks about hot topics, entertainment, sports, and her show's at 7 p.m. And then it brings us back to next week at 6 p.m., and we'll be doing a really funny film called Baby Boom. It is one of my favorite films, and it has one of my favorite actors, Diane Keaton, and so, yes. I hope you can join us 6 p.m. next week. I guarantee you it's going to be much more upbeat, and you probably will only shed maybe one or two tears, or not. I shed them because, you know, there are certain things that bother me. Other than that, we'll see you next week or whenever you get a chance to join us for Film Plus Psychology, Filmcology. Thank you, everyone, for listening in. Take care and have a great weekend.
Good night.
Thanks. Good night.